Not this one, Count. Very healthy, very fit. She will produce well for us, though we are still configuring her uterus to produce the chemical compounds necessary for the Amal precursor. Then we can link the other tanks to her and produce more. Fenring found nothing erotic about the helpless lump of flesh, as different from his own beautiful wife as a woman could possibly be. Why is she so special? She was a spy, Count. We captured her poking around, disguised as a male. I'm surprised all the females around here don't disguise themselves and hide. This one was a Bene Gesserit. Fenring could not cover his astonishment. The Sisterhood knows about our operations here? Damn that Anirul. I should have killed her. The witches have some inkling of what we are up to. Therefore, we do not have much time. Agitica kneaded his hands together. You see, you cannot execute me now. You dare not bring all this work to a halt. The Emperor must have his Amal. We can work out our minor differences later. Fenring raised his eyebrows. You call the destruction of an entire Highliner with the loss of all passengers a minor difference? You say I should just forget your face dancer's assassination attempt on me?
Oh, yes. Yes, I do. In the scheme of the entire universe, such events are insignificant.
Insanity flashed in the little man's eyes.
I cannot let you cause problems now, Count Fenring. The importance of my work goes beyond you, or House Corino, or the Imperium itself. I just need a little more time.
Fenring turned, intending to snap orders at the Sardaukar, but saw a strange quality in their eyes as they looked at Agitica, a zealous devotion that astonished him. Of all things, he had never suspected the loyalty of Sardaukar would be questionable. These men were obviously addicted to the synthetic spice, their bodies crackling with the power of artificial melange. Had the master researcher brainwashed them, too?
I will not let you stop me.
Agitica's threat was clear. Not now. Inside the research pavilion, Tleilaxu workers took notice and came closer. Some of them might be face dancers as well. Fenring's stomach sank, and for the first time in his entire life he felt the cold grip of true fear. He was alone here. Over the years he had often belittled Agitica's abilities, but now he saw that the master researcher had managed to put an astonishing plan in place. Surrounded, Fenring realized that he might never get off this planet alive. Waiting. Time passes slowly. More than a lifetime, it seems. When will our nightmare end? Each day drags on, though hope endures. Keter Pilru. Fragment from his secret journals. The man-machine stood outside the shambles of an Ixion weapons manufactory. During the decades of Tleilaxu occupation, the assembly lines that produced complex machinery and technological marvels had been poorly maintained, abandoned, or used for other purposes. The invaders were not knowledgeable enough to keep sophisticated systems running smoothly, and the skilled Ixion workers passively resisted in every way. Just days before, the last groaning and shuddering stations on the production line had seized up. Engines smoked. Components ground together and broke down. During the emergency, the workers had just watched. The underground world had been slowly sliding into disorder and decay. Repair technicians half-heartedly removed the ruined assembly line components. But the Tleilaxu overlords had no replacement parts. Workers at other machines tried to look busy, while prowling Sardaukar guards and Tleilaxu masters kept a close watch. Surveillance pods drifted overhead, searching for anything out of the ordinary. Prince Romber hid in plain sight. He stood like a statue in front of the bustling facility. Ixion workers glanced at him, then looked away without seeing, without recognizing.
Years of oppression had deadened their minds and senses. His scarred face and the metal skullcap were exposed, like badges of honor. The prosthetic skin on his artificial limbs had been peeled away to reveal pulleys, electronics, and mechanical enhancements. A better approximation of the clumsy Bi-Ixian monstrosities. Gurney had even dirtied him up. While Romber could not pretend to be completely human, he could masquerade as something far less than he was. Chemical smoke poured toward the cavern ceiling, where air exchangers absorbed and filtered the particulates. But even the best purification systems could not remove the traces of innocent people living in fear. Romber's eyes, both the real and the synthetic, examined everything around him. He felt revulsion, nausea, and anger to see the ruin of this once wondrous city, and could hardly endure any more. With 0 hour fast approaching for the arrival of Atreides' forces, he hoped he could seed the revolution quickly enough to make a difference. When he began to move, Romber took slow, jerky steps, wandering aimlessly like one of the Tleilaxu's reanimated Bi-Ixians. Romber made his way under a darkened overhang beside the broken-down factory. Unnoticed among the work crew and guards, Gurney Halleck signaled him. Beside the ink-vine-scarred man stood the broken shadow of someone Romber remembered from a shared youth. In astonishment at the man's stark appearance, he whispered, "Kater Pilru." This had once been a vibrant young man, dark-eyed and small in stature, like his twin Demur. But in some ways, Kater's changes seemed even more horrifying than the navigator's alterations. The eyes were fatigue-laden and sunken. The dark hair stuck out in unwashed spikes.
"My prince?"
His voice was whispery and uncertain. He had suffered too many hallucinations and broken dreams. Appalled to see the horrific changes in the heir to House Vernius, Kater seemed ready to break down. Gurney squeezed his arm in a vice-like grip. "Careful, both of you. We must not draw attention to ourselves. We dare not stay here in the open for long."
"I have a place," Kater said. "Several places."
"We must spread the word." Romber's voice was low, determined. "Inform those who have given up and those who have retained a spark of hope for all these years. We will even enlist the aid of the Suboids. Tell everyone that the Prince of Ix has returned. Freedom is no longer an improbable hope. The time is now. Let there be no question. We are about to retake Ix."
"It is very dangerous for anyone to say such things aloud, my prince," Kader said. "The people live in terror."
"Pass the word anyway, even if it causes the monsters to seek me out. My people need to know that I am back and that the long, dark nightmare of Ix will soon be over. Tell them to be ready. Duke Leto's forces arrive soon." Romber reached out with a powerful prosthetic arm and embraced the emaciated freedom fighter. Even to the prince's clumsy nerve sensors, Kater felt skeletal. He hoped Leto would not delay. Making a sport of war is a move toward sophistication. When you govern men of military temper, you must understand their passionate need for war. Supreme Bashar Zoom-Garon, Imperial Sardaukar Commander. On the day of departure for Ix, the Atreides troops went to their ships with an air of euphoria. But the reality of war would soon set in. Swordmaster Duncan Idaho and the Mentat Thufir Hawat accompanied Leto as he stood atop a speaking tower that overlooked the spaceport field. Caladan had not witnessed such a gathering since the fateful Skyclipper procession. Row upon row of military vessels glinted in the morning sun. Uniformed, fiercely loyal Atreides soldiers stood in ranks,
A sea of men ready to mount the transports, destroyers, monitors, and battle cruisers. For over two decades, the Tleilaxu usurpers and their Sardaukar allies had entrenched themselves on Ix. Many spies had died trying to get inside that world. And if Romber and Gurney had been captured and tortured, the Atreides assault force might have lost their element of surprise. Leto knew he could forfeit everything with this gamble, but he did not consider calling off the attack. Not for a moment. Under Hawat's separate command, 18 supply ships were ready to depart with a small armed escort. The Mentat's bold move would be the obvious one, but a diversion. His relief fleet would appear between Bayakal and the San Sin transfer station, where they would broadcast Leto's humanitarian offer. Presumably, the Sardaukar officers in the blockade would send messages to the Emperor, and in turn Shaddam would focus his attention on the quarantined world. The Imperial military would be drawn there. Meanwhile, no doubt, Lansrad delegates in the Hall of Oratory would extol the generosity of Duke Atreides. At about that time, Duncan Idaho's assault would strike Ix like a hammer. Crowds on the landing field pressed against the ribbons strung along the perimeter, colorful strands that fluttered in a light wind. People cheered and waved black and green pennants bearing the heraldic hawk crest, the ancient sigil of House Atreides. Sweethearts, wives, and mothers called out to the soldiers assembled on the field, encouraging them. In a flurry of activity, many of the young men rushed back to the barricades for goodbye kisses. Often it didn't even matter if they knew the pretty women seeing them off. It was simply a reassurance that someone cared about their safety and wished them well. Duke Leto could not help but think of Jessica, separated from him for months, living in luxury in the Imperial Palace. Very soon now she would bear his child, and he longed to be with her. That was the best advantage of his going to Kaitane. Leto had taken great care to dress himself in a scarlet matador's uniform similar to the one his father had so proudly worn for bullfights. It was a significant symbol, one easily recognized by the citizens of Caladan. When Leto wore red, the crowd saw not an echo of bloodshed, from which the Atreides' Red Dukes had drawn their appellation long ago, but of pageantry and glory. The boarding ramps opened, and sub-commanders shouted their men into ranks. One troop broke into a familiar Atreides battle song. As they shouted off-key into the hubbub, other soldiers took up the refrain, and soon all the uniformed men had joined in the chorus, a resounding celebration of defiance, determination, and love for their duke. The song concluded, and just before the first ranks began to board the warships, Leto stepped to the edge of the tower. The troops fell silent, waiting for his send-off speech. In the Akazi Revolt, many years ago, Duke Paulus Atreides fought side by side with Earl Dominic Vernius. These great men were war heroes and fast friends. Much time has passed since then, and many tragedies have occurred. But we must never forget one thing. House Atreides does not abandon its friends. A surge of cheering swept through the crowd. Under other circumstances, the general populace might not have cared about the renegade family. For the common folk of Caladan, Ix was a distant world they would never visit. But they had taken Prince Romber into their hearts. Our soldiers will retake the ancestral home of House Vernius. My friend, Prince Romber, will rescue the Ixian people and restore their freedom. On Caladan and many other imperial planets, the people had learned to hate the Tleilaxu. Ix was undoubtedly the most heinous example of their misbehavior, but there were numerous other instances. For centuries, the gnomish men had gotten away with too much, and now it was time to administer Atreides' justice.
Leto continued. We do not pick and choose when to be moral, when to follow the correct path and assist others who need us. And that is why I have sent my Mentat Thufir-Hawat on a mission of his own. He surveyed the crowd. Not long ago, we had to take stern action against the Prime Magistrate of Beakal. But now that Beakal's people are suffering from a terrible plague that is devastating their world, should we simply ignore them because I had a quarrel with their government? He raised a fist in the air. I say no! The people cheered again, though a bit less enthusiastically this time. Other great houses are content to watch the Beakali population die, but House Atreides will challenge the imperial blockade and deliver much-needed relief supplies, just as we did for Rachis. He lowered his voice. We would want others to do the same for us, would we not? Leto was confident they understood the principle and the choice. After gaining stature in the Landsraad with his aggressive response to the original Beakali insult, he had shown a more compassionate side by assisting the victims on Rachis. Now he would prove the strength of his heart. He remembered a quote from the Orange Catholic Bible. It is easy to love a friend, hard to love an enemy. I will travel directly to Kaitane alone, where I will talk with my cousin, the Emperor, and deliver a formal speech to the Landsraad. He paused and felt emotion well up inside. I will also see my beloved Lady Jessica, who is about to give birth to our first child. Whoops and whistles erupted. Atreides' pennants waved. The people had long perceived their duke and his activities at Castle Caladan as myth and legend. The commoners needed such images. Finally, he raised a hand in benediction, and the roar of the crowd and soldiers nearly deafened him. Beside him on the observation tower, Duncan and Thufir watched as the soldiers boarded their assigned ships, marching in perfect ranks. Such a military display would have impressed even Emperor Shaddam himself. Leto felt an inner warmth as waves of confidence and good expectations from his people washed over him. He vowed not to disappoint them. The face of the Imperium was about to shift. The man who sees an opportunity and does nothing is asleep with his eyes open. Fremen Wisdom. Back home on Gedi Prime, Glossu Rabban enjoyed being in charge of Harkonnen Keep. From the high stone-walled fortress, he could command the servants, announce his own gladiatorial tournaments, and keep the population under firm control. It was his privilege as a noble of the Landsraad. Better still, he had no wily Mentat to breathe down his neck or criticize him for everything he tried to do. Peter de Vries was playing his diplomatic spy games on Kaitane. And Rabban's uncle had remained on Arrakis to monitor the complex spice operations under the threat of Choam inspections and audits, which left the beast alone and in charge. He was technically the Na Baron, the heir apparent to House Harkonnen, though the Baron had often threatened to change his mind and cede control to young Fade Rautha. Unless Rabban could find some way to prove himself invaluable. He stood in the keep's east wing at the animal pens, where the stench of the hounds hung dense and feral in the corridors. Wet fur and blood, saliva and feces, piled up and grew old, as the animals thrashed in their pit enclosure below the walkway. With gleaming black eyes, the dogs fought for a glimpse of daylight or a scrap of fresh meat, snapping at imaginary enemies with their long fangs. Like the alpha male of the pack, Rabban growled back at the hounds, curling his thick lips to expose uneven white teeth. Squatting, he reached into a cage at the edge of the walkway and yanked out a squirming simian rabbit.
The creature's eyes were huge and round, its ears floppy. Its prehensile tail twitched, as it feared for its life, yet longed for affection. Rabban's strong fingers gripped the folds of soft skin and warm fur so tightly that the creature trembled. He held it high to let the hounds see the morsel of food. In the kennel pit, the animals began to bark and snarl, leaping high. Their claws skittered on slimy stone walls, but the hounds fell short of the kennel edge. The furry creature in Rabban's grip flinched and kicked, trying to escape from the nightmare of snapping jaws. A voice interrupted from behind, shockingly close. "Maintaining your image, beast?" The interruption startled him so much that he inadvertently released his grip. The simian rabbit dropped, flailing toward the pit. One leaping hound, a big gray Brewweiler, snatched it from the air and tore the scrap of food to bloody shreds before the doomed victim could even make a squeak. Rabban whirled to see the dark-haired, fiery-eyed Viscount Hundro Moritani standing behind him. The man's big-knuckled hands were propped on his scale-armored jodhpurs. Broad epaulets flared on his surcoat, made of crimson overlapping silk scales. Before Rabban could splutter a reply, Captain Kriubi, head of the Harkonnen House Guard, hurried up at a brisk pace, followed by an agitated-looking aide, who also wore the shoulder pads and lapel crest of House Moritani. "I'm sorry, my Lord Rabban," Kriubi said, out of breath. "The Viscount proceeded without my permission. While I was attempting to locate you, he..." The Grumman leader just smiled. Rabban waved Kriubi to silence. "We'll deal with that later, Captain, if this turns out to be a waste of my time." Feeling slightly off balance, he turned his broad shoulders and looked Moritani straight in the eye. "What do you want?" Technically, the Viscount outranked him in the Landsrad, and the man had already proven his vengeful temper against House Ikaz as well as the swordmasters of Ginaz. "I want to offer you a chance to join me in an enjoyable strategic game." Trying to regain his composure, Rabban grabbed another simian rabbit from the cage. He held the creature by the back of its neck, so that no matter how it flipped its prehensile tail, it could not get a grasp on Rabban's wrist. "I thought only House Harkonnen would enjoy the irony as much as I," Moritani continued. "I also thought you would be willing to seize the opportunity Duke Leto's poor planning has presented to us." Rabban dangled the rabbit over the hound pen. The dogs snapped and growled, trying to reach the tantalizing treat. But the beast held it far out of their reach. The terrified, writhing rabbit released its bladder, and a stream of urine rained down into the pen. But the dogs didn't seem to mind. When Rabban felt the creature had reached the peak of its fear, he flung it, with disgust, to the dogs. "So explain yourself. I'm waiting. What does House Atreides have to do with this?" The Viscount raised his bushy eyebrows. "I believe that you have even less love for Duke Leto Atreides than do I." Rabban glowered. "Any fool knows that much. At this very moment, Duke Leto is on his way to Kaitain. He is scheduled to speak before the Landsrad. So, do you expect me to rush to Kaitain for a front-row seat?" The Viscount smiled patiently, like a parent waiting for a child to understand a point. "His mentat, Thufir Hawat, has apparently gone to deliver supplies to Beakal. And," Moritani held up his index finger, "without any fanfare, Leto has dispatched virtually all House Atreides' troops and ships on a secret military mission." "To where? How did you find out about this?"
"I found out about it, Beast Rabban, because one cannot move a force of that size, filling so many guild ships, without attracting notice from even the most incompetent of spies."
"All right," Rabban said. The wheels in his mind spun, but found no traction. "So you know about it. Where is this Atreides task force going? Is Gidi Prime in danger?"
"Oh, not Gidi Prime. House Atreides is much too civilized for an underhanded action like that. In fact, I'm not concerned about their target, so long as it's not you or me. So why should I care? Rabban, if you do your mathematics correctly, you will realize that these careful and coordinated Atreides movements leave Leto's beloved Caladan protected by only a skeleton force. If we make a concentrated military strike now, we could strip him of his ancestral home. The simian rabbits in the cage squeaked and squirmed, and Rabban kicked the mesh bars, but that only served to heighten their agitation. Kriubi stood back, his thin mustache wrinkling as he pursed his lips in contemplation. The guard captain would not speak or offer tactical advice unless Rabban specifically requested it. The nervous-looking aide hurried to Moritani's side.
"My Viscount, you know that it is not wise. Striking a planet without giving fair warning, without first fighting a dispute with the Landsrad, and without formally challenging an opposing noble house, goes strictly against the rules of Canley. You know the forms as well as anyone, sir. You—"
"Silence," the Viscount said, without raising his voice even slightly. The aide clamped his mouth shut with an audible click. But Rabban had wanted to hear the answers to the aide's objections, because the agitated man was raising questions he himself hadn't wanted to ask for fear of looking like a coward. "May I?" Moritani asked, and reached into the rabbit cage. He grabbed a squirming ball of fur and held it up over the pit. "Interesting. Do you ever place bets on which hound will get the prey?" Rabban shook his head. "This is just feeding." The Viscount let go. Again the large gray Bruweiler outleaped his companions and snatched the rabbit out of the air. Rabban decided to cull that aggressive dog and turn it loose in the next gladiatorial event. "Rules are for old men who prefer to walk in the wheel ruts of history," the Viscount said. He had brutally attacked his arch-rival House Akaz by carpet-bombing the entire capital peninsula, killing the Archduke's eldest daughter, and rekindling a feud that had simmered for generations.
"Indeed, and you faced years of imperial sanctions for breaking the rules," Rabban said. "Sardaukar troops stationed on your world, commerce interrupted."
The Grumman Lord didn't seem to care a bit.
"Yes, but that's all over now. Years ago, when Duke Leto had tried to broker a peace between Moritani and Akaz, he had shown bias in favor of House Akaz. Might even have been betrothed to a daughter of the Archduke at one time. But vengeance didn't enter into Moritani's proposal as much as simple exploitation of an opportunity. Still, I am forbidden from moving many troops because of Shaddam's strictures. I brought as many as I could comfortably slip away from the observers."
"Here? To Gedi Prime?" Rabban was alarmed.
"Well, just a friendly visit." Moritani shrugged. "It occurred to me, however, that House Harkonnen can launch as much military force as it wishes, with no added scrutiny. So I ask you now, will you join me in this daring enterprise?"
Rabban took a deep breath, shocked into momentary silence. Kriubi shuffled his feet uneasily, but said nothing.
"You want Harkonnen troops to join yours? Grumman's and Harkonnen's attacking Caladan?"
"At the moment, Caladan has almost no defenses," Moritani reminded him. "According to our intelligence report, only a few youths and old men with small weapons remain. But we must act quickly, for Leto won't leave his doors wide open for long."
"What have you got to lose? Let's go!"
"Duke Leto may also be counting on the rules of Canley, to which all houses are bound, sir," Kriubi said in a dry voice. "The forms must be obeyed."
The nervous aide straightened his lapel crest and beseeched his master.
"My lord Viscount, this action is too rash. I beg you to reconsider."
With a sharp and vicious move of his shoulder, Hundro Moritani knocked his own aide sprawling over the edge and down into the kennel pit. Unlike the rabbits, the aide had time to scream as the hounds attacked him.
The Grumman smiled at Rabban.
Sometimes one must act unexpectedly in order to secure the greatest benefit.
The aide stopped squirming below, and the hungry animals tore his body apart.
Rabban could hear the wet, ripping sound of meat, the sharp cracks of leg bones being broken open for their fresh, hot marrow. He nodded slowly, ominously.
Caladan will be ours.
I like the sound of that.
Under joint occupation, Mauritani said.
Oh, yes, of course. And how do you propose that we defend our prize once we take it? As soon as the Duke returns, he'll have his force, assuming he doesn't lose it somewhere.
Mauritani smiled.
To begin, we make certain no messages leave Caladan. After our forces are successful, we restrict shuttle transport to and from any arriving highliners.
And we set up a surprise party for Duke Leto when he comes back, Rabban said. We ambush him as soon as he lands.
Exactly. We can work out the details together. We may also need to bring in reinforcements after the fact, a full occupation force to subdue the populace.
The coarse Harkonnen air set his thick lips in a firm line.
The last time he had taken matters into his own hands, he had crashed the only existing no-ship on Wallach 9. He'd attempted to attack the smug Bene Gesserit witches who had contaminated the Baron with their disease. Back then, Rabban had thought his uncle would be proud of him for acting independently. Instead, the plan had not gone well, and the priceless ship had been lost. This time, however, he knew his uncle wouldn't hesitate, given such an opportunity to strike against the mortal enemies of House Harkonnen. Cautiously, he looked over at the Viscount. Captain Kriubi gave a silent but well-considered nod of assent.
So long as we use unmarked ships, Viscount, Rabban said. We make it look like a big trade delegation or something, anything but a military force.
You have brains, Count Rabban.
I think we will work well together.
Rabban beamed at the compliment. Hopefully this bold decision would show his uncle how smart the beast really was.
They shook hands on the deal.
Below, the sounds of feeding faded, and the bristling muscular hounds looked up from their kennel, hoping for more.
Does knowledge increase a person's burden more, or ignorance? Every teacher must consider this question before beginning to alter a student. Lady Anirul Corino, Private Journal. Beneath another glorious imperial sunset, Mohiam crept up behind Jessica, who sat beside a small pool in an ornamental garden. For a long moment, the truth-sayer observed her secret daughter. The young woman carried her advanced pregnancy well, comfortable with the new awkwardness of her body. The baby would be born soon. Jessica reached forward to swirl her fingertips in the pool, blurring her reflection. She spoke out of the corner of her mouth.
"I must be very entertaining, Reverend Mother, for you to stand there watching me."
Mohiam wrinkled her lips in a small smile.
"I expected you to sense I was here, child. After all, who taught you to observe the world around you?"
She came to the edge of the pool and held out a memory crystal.
"Lady Anirul has asked me to give this to you. There are certain things she would have you know."
Jessica took the glittering object, studied it.
"Is the lady well?"
Mohiam's tone was guarded. "I believe her condition will improve considerably once your daughter is born. She is most concerned about the child, and this is causing her great distress."
Jessica looked away, afraid Mohiam might see her flush.
"I don't understand, Reverend Mother. Why should the baby of a duke's concubine be of such importance?
Come to a place where we can sit, in private."
They walked toward a solar-operated carousel that a previous emperor had installed for his amusement. Jessica wore a maternity dress in Atreides' colors that reminded her of Leto. The bodily changes from her pregnancy had unleashed many conflicting emotions inside her, shifting moods she could barely control even with her Bene Gesserit training. Each day she had poured her loving thoughts into the bound parchment journal Anirul had given her. The Duke was a proud man, but Jessica knew in her heart that he missed her. Mohiam took a seat on the gilded carousel bench, and Jessica joined her, still holding the memory crystal. Activated by their weight, the mechanism began to spin slowly. Jessica watched the changing garden view as it passed in front of her. On a nearby post, draped with bougainvillea, a dangling glow globe flickered on, though the sun had not yet dropped below the horizon. Since her arrival on Kaitain, especially after Tyros Refa's surprise stunt in front of the Imperial box, Jessica had been watched constantly by hovering Bene Gesserit guardians. Though she gave no sign of annoyance, Jessica could not have failed to notice their doting protection.
"Why am I so special? What does the sisterhood want with my baby?"
Jessica turned the memory crystal over in her hands. It was octagonal, glimmering with lavender facets. Mohiam brought out a companion crystal and held it.
"Go ahead, child. Activate it."
Jessica rolled the sparkling device between her palms and then cupped it in her hands, warming it with her body heat, moistening it with her perspiration to energize the custom memories stored inside. As she looked into it, staring with focused attention, the crystal began to project image beams that intersected across her retinas. Beside her, Mohiam activated the companion crystal. Jessica closed her eyes and felt a bone-deep hum, like that of a guild ship entering fold space. When she opened her eyes again, her vision had changed. She seemed to be inside the Bene Gesserit archives, far from Kaitain. Deep within the translucent cliffs of Wallach Nine, the walls and ceilings of the huge library facility reflected prismatic illumination, shuttling light across billions of jeweled surfaces. Immersed in a sensory projection, she and Mohiam stood together at the virtual entrance. The illusion felt incredibly real. Mohiam said,
"I will be your guide, Jessica, so that you can understand your importance."
Jessica stood silently, intrigued yet intimidated. "When you left the mother school," Mohiam began, "had you learned everything there was to know?"
"No, Reverend Mother.
But I had learned how to obtain the information I needed." When Mohiam's image took Jessica by the hand, she seemed to feel the older woman's strong grip and dry skin.
"Quite so, child, and this is one of the important places to look. Come, I will show you amazing things."
They passed through a tunnel into darkness that expanded around Jessica. She sensed, but could not see, an immense black chamber with walls and ceiling far beyond reach. Jessica wanted to cry out. Her pulse raced. She used her training to slow it down, but too late. The other woman had noticed. Mohiam's dry voice broke the silence.
"Are you frightened?"
"Fear is the mind killer, Reverend Mother. I will allow it to pass over me and through me.
What is this darkness, and what can I learn from it?"
"This represents what you still do not know. This is the universe you have not yet seen, and which you cannot possibly imagine. At the beginning of time, darkness reigned. In the end, it will be the same. Our lives are but pinpoints of light in between, like the smallest stars in the heavens."
Mohiam's voice came close to her ear.
Kwisatz Haderach. Tell me what that name means to you.
The Reverend Mother let go of her hand, and Jessica felt herself float off the ground, blind in the saturated blackness. She shivered, fought panic.
It is one of the sisterhood's breeding programs. That is all I know.
This black pit of hidden knowledge around you contains every secret in the universe, the fears, hopes, and dreams of humanity, all that we have ever been and can ever achieve. This is the potential of the Kwisatz Haderach. He is the culmination of our most exacting breeding programs, the powerful male Bene Gesserit who can bridge space and time. He is the human of all humans, a god in man form. Unconsciously, Jessica held her hands over her rounded belly, where her unborn child, the Duke's son, curled in the security of her womb, where it must be as dark as this chamber. Her old teacher's voice was brittle, as dry as sticks.
Hear me, Jessica. After thousands of years of careful Bene Gesserit planning, the daughter you carry is destined to give birth to the Kwisatz Haderach.
That is why such care has been taken to ensure your safety. Lady Anirul Sado Tonkin Corino is the Kwisatz mother, your sworn protector. It is by her command that you now learn your place in the events unfolding around you. Jessica was too overwhelmed to speak. Her knees buckled in the weightless blackness. For the love of Leto, she had defied the Bene Gesserit. She was carrying a son, not a daughter. And her sisters did not know.
Do you understand what has been revealed to you, child? I have taught you many things. Do you grasp the importance?
Jessica's voice was small.
I understand, Reverend Mother.
She didn't dare admit her transgression now, could think of no one in whom she could confide her terrible secret, especially not her stern teacher.
Why didn't they tell me before?
Steeling herself, Jessica thought of Leto, and of his anguish following the death of Victor, caused by the treachery of his concubine, Kylea.
I did it for him.
Despite the Bene Gesserit strictures against being swayed by emotions, Jessica had come to believe that her superiors had no right to interfere with the love between a man and a woman. Why were they so afraid of it? Nothing in her training answered this question. Had Jessica single-handedly destroyed the Kwisatz Haderach program, ruining millennia of work? Confusion, anger, and fear mixed within her.
I can always have other daughters.
If it was so important, why hadn't she been told earlier? Damn them and their schemes! She sensed her teacher behind her and recalled a day on Wallach 9 when she had been forced to undergo a test of her own humanity. Reverend Mother Mohiam had held a poisonous gum jabar at her creamy neck. One slip, and the deadly needle would have penetrated her skin, killing her instantly.